Welcome, everybody. My name is Janice Bellucci. I'm the founder and executive director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. And so you're here for the monthly Zoom meeting of the Alliance. We call it the Alliance sometimes, we call it AXOL sometimes. The full name is the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. So we've been in existence now for about 15 years. We've helped so many people during those 15 years. And guess what? We've got a lot more to do, as you well know. So again, thank you here for joining us. Date today is February 21, 2026, and let's get this meeting started. And of course, the person we always want to hear from very early is Marty Weiss. Take it away, Marty.
Thank you, Janice. One second here. And okay, I just something in the chat. All right. So we all know the traumatic effects of the registry on ourselves and our loved ones. Bullying, isolation, loneliness, loss of family and friends, difficulty securing work and housing. We just heard one, story. Life can be difficult for everyone affected. That's why AXOL runs emotional support group meetings every week. Our next meetings will be on Thursday and 1 week from today. And by the way, these groups are not just for registrants. Our loved ones and supporters are welcome to attend too. Thursday evenings. AXOL board member Sherry Moreno runs the group beginning at 6:30 Pacific, 9:30 Eastern. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, licensed therapist and AXOL board member Alex Kittinger leads the Saturday afternoon meetings. The time, 3 o'clock Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern. At every meeting, we have a friendly community supporting each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant so we don't have trolls, bullies, law enforcement, or haters. How can you participate in these wonderful groups? Please see the information I just posted in the chat and will do again later on as well. And if you don't have access to the chat, you can go to the AXOL website, click on the emotional support group link on the homepage and follow the directions there. And I promise, after participating in the AXOL emotional support groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. And I'd just like to add, I'd rather be a registrant at an AXOL emotional support group meeting with caring friends than the children of parents lost to the Lake Tahoe avalanche, kids who now and forever will see cruel online posts criticizing their parents for going on a dangerous venture, and yet not one caring, loving, supportive word from those same critics to help the kid. Those heartless critics are the same people who are the most vocal about us too. Think about it.
Wow. Thank you, Marty. I didn't read any of those comments, but they're just terrible.
I did. And I cried.
I bet. I cried for the people who died. And then I'm not, Okay. Well, and their families as well. So sending them thoughts and prayers.
Absolutely. And we know who the good people in this world are. You know what? We're right here. We're the ones who are moving forward with positivity in our life. We're doing the best we can.
Yeah. Thank you, Marty. Thank you.
Thank you, Jess.
Okay. So, what Marty was talking about, emotional support group meetings are really important. These monthly meetings that we have here on Zoom, it's not about emotions. Okay. I'm a counselor, but I'm a legal counselor. So we're talking about laws. We're talking sometimes about regulations, but we're not talking about feelings. But I know that a lot of people have a lot of strong feelings about the issues that you face every day or your loved ones face every day. And so, going to these emotional support group meetings can really produce some fabulous results. And I know that one woman who was on the registry, and she went to the emotional support group meetings for just a few years, and she just bloomed like a rose. And in fact, she became such an effective speaker that we asked her to join us on the board of directors. So things can happen. Things can happen like that. So before I go on, I want to introduce two board members who've joined us already. Roger Honeycutt, many of you mentioned or met him earlier before the meeting began because he was addressing some technical issues that people had with accessing the meeting, and Rick Chu, who's on our Family Safety Foundation Board of Directors. So welcome, Rick. Nice to have you here. Okay, so there's a lot to talk about today, folks. But maybe one before I go on, I want to remind you all that the reason that AXOL exists is to help you. We are here to help you. We're here to support you. We're here to love you. We are a judgment-free zone. We know many people were convicted of offenses they didn't even do, but for one reason or another, including district attorneys offering you something that you may or not, may or may not have received. So we are here to help you. Okay. We are a resource. We can help people sometimes with employment, sometimes with housing. We can almost always help you with legal issues. So please, please, please contact AXOL. And Roger, would you be so kind as to put my contact information in the chat room there, both my phone number and my email address. But this phone number is my cell phone number. Okay. You will not get a secretary or any administrative assistant who answers my phone. It's me. Sometimes people are surprised by that, but the fact is I don't have an admin. I have a legal assistant, but I don't have an administrative assistant. Just in case I don't answer the phone, it usually means I'm in court or I'm already on the phone talking to somebody else. Leave a voicemail message. Okay. I normally answer the phone or return your call rather within 24 hours. And just in case I don't return your call within 24 hours, please call me again. I'm not going to be upset if you call me multiple times, except that don't call me 3 times in 10 minutes. Okay, if I'm not available the first time you call me in 10 minutes, I'm not going to be available the second time or the third time. Again, it means I'm in court or I'm already in a phone meeting with somebody else. So just leave me a voicemail message and I will call you back as soon as I can. So somebody asked a question here, and I'm going to go ahead and say the question was about asking for an address for the Department of Justice here in California for somebody's tier assignment. I just want to be really clear about that. If you're in California rather, and you want to know your tier assignment, the Department of Justice actually is one who assigns you to a tier, but they will not tell you what your tier is, as curious as that is. Instead, the place where you go to get your tier assignment is the registration office. So the place where you register on an annually, that's the place where you're going to get your tier assignment. And you need to ask for a specific form, and the form number is 8050, 8050. I put it over in the chat part of it. The name of the 8050 form is proof of current registration. Again, proof of current registration. So it's a two-page form. It's nothing like your annual registration, which is 5 or 6 pages. It's a two-page form. And on page one of the form is indeed your tier assignment. Okay. So please, 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 if you want to know what your tier assignment is, go ask for that document. You can call me and I can give you an educated guess as to your tier assignment. But if you want to get the government answer, in this case, you do want a government answer, then please go to the office where you register and they will give you that form 8050, proof of current registration. So I wasn't expecting to talk about that right away, but since somebody asked about that in chat, I thought I should bring it to everybody's attention. Okay. All right. And so one of the people, I guess the person who asked that question said, I guess her husband's already gotten his form 8050 and it says to be determined. So let me explain what's going on there. The situation is if you have an out-of-state conviction and you move into state of California, the Department of Justice has up to 2 years to determine your tier assignment. I think that's ridiculous, but that's what the law says. And unfortunately, most of the time, DOJ takes the 2 years to make the tier assignment. Now, if you're lucky enough that you're convicted in California, you moved out of the state, and you come back into the state, your tier assignment's going to happen a lot quicker. The reason it takes so much time for DOJ to do that, and I'm not completely defending them, only partially, is if you were convicted out of state, they have to compare what you were convicted of to all the sex offenses in the state of California, and then find out what they consider to be the equivalent offense. Many times they contact the state and they ask for lots of documents, and I think that's one reason it takes so long. I really, think they could do a better job of it. We'll just leave it at that. Okay, so one of the things that I promised to talk about today, and let's just start out with that right away, is in fact a bill that's been introduced in Congress. So it's H.R. 7453, 7453, and the H.R. stands for House of Representatives. So in fact, it was introduced in the House of Representatives by a congressman who's from Florida. He happens to be a Republican, and his last name is S. Teube. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. I'm going to call it Stubbe right now. And I know I don't mean to offend him if I got the pronunciation wrong. But folks, I'm very concerned about this bill because it basically says, now it's a bill, it's not a law, okay? Hopefully it'll never become a law, but when there are bills introduced like this, we really need to stay on top of it and we all need to work together to stop it, okay? So this bill, if it became law, would prevent people on the registry from getting access to Medicaid benefit. I'm like, what the heck does that have to do with anything? Yeah, thank you, Dave, for your hand gesture there. I don't know. I mean, is this animus? Is this perhaps this congressman himself was sexually abused? If so, I feel very sorry for him. But this is not the way to solve any problems. In fact, of course, it would create so many worse problems than we already have. So we haven't taken a formal position. Well, that's not true. We have taken a formal position, Axel. I've written a letter of opposition, and it's on our Axel website. You can look look at it and, find out why, what things you could say. We certainly, if you are urging people to do something about this, it's very early in the process, by the way, but do something about it to let this congressman know that this is not something that should ever see the light of day. So again, another thing you can do, you can contact your own congressional representative and let him or her know that this bill has been introduced. At some point in time, he or she might have to vote on this bill, right? And certainly bring it to their attention how terrible a bill it is. So again, it's H.R. 7453. It was introduced on February 9th. So just last week it was introduced. It's been referred to two different committees, both the Ways and Means Committee as well as the Energy and Commerce Committee. I have no idea why I went to Energy and Commerce, but it did. And so, it has to travel through those committees, and that's going to take some time, thank goodness. And so that gives us an opportunity, quite frankly, to voice our opposition to the bill before anything major happens. As it turns out, Roger and I are going to be back in DC for the vigil, and the vigil is on Saturday, March 7. Is that right, Roger? March 7. And so what we're going to do, we're going to, the day before, we are going to go to the congressman's office, and we're going to let him know that we are opposed to the bill and why. We're also planning to go to the offices where we're represented and let our let you know we can, and by the way, you can always do that, and you don't necessarily have to go to Washington, D.C. to do it. You can contact their local office too as a constituent. Anywhere that you're a constituent, they absolutely have to listen to you. So it's best to make an appointment first for a meeting if you're going to go, even to the local office. But you know what? The fact is, you can walk in the front door and say, I'm a constituent, and they have to pay attention to you. So I just want everybody to know that. And it's something, I think this is a time for questions. While you're thinking about it, what I would like to say is it is that the question about who's a registrant is on the federal level, it's not decided yet, okay? And so we've got a case pending where Axcel is actually a plaintiff in the case. This is a SORNA case about SORNA regulations, and the position of the government in that case is, in fact, that anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense is, quote, a sex offender. I hate that term. I prefer to use the term registrant, but that's the term they're using. Okay, so in this legislation now that's been introduced, it's possible that they mean for anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense would no longer be able to receive Medicaid benefits. So we have one of our board members, Sherry Moreno is her name. She's one, by the way, one of the people who, in fact, is leads emotional support group meetings. But Sherry also is somebody who works with people who receive Medicaid funding through a nonprofit organization, and they are helping people who have mental and emotional issues. And she basically said, their organization, their nonprofit, would probably go out of business if, in fact, the Medicaid funds were no longer available to people on the registry. They work with people, justice involved, I think is the latest phrase, right? They're justice involved, not just people on the registry, but at least they would no longer be able to provide services to people who are on the registry. So I see there's a whole lot of messages here. Let me take it. Okay, thank you, Roger, for putting that up. Okay, lots of comments here. Okay, good. All right. So let's go back to the tier issue again. So somebody says, I do not believe tiers will be lowered without a court action or legislature law change. That's very true. And actually, it's not court action. The court cannot change somebody's tier assignment. They can't. Okay. So just understand that. You have to persuade the Department of Justice to give you a new tier. It can be done in some cases, very narrow cases. Like there's some cases where somebody's convicted of a felony that's considered a wobbler that can be reduced to a misdemeanor. If that should happen, then in fact you can get a new tier assignment from DOJ, Department of Justice. Okay, what we are working as an organization very strongly for is in fact to change the tiered registry law, because right now the tiered registry law in California, it only makes about half of the people on the registry eligible to petition for removal, and unfortunately the other half are not eligible. So that means you're still on a lifetime registry, right? And which is a terrible thing and shouldn't be happening. So what we're doing as an organization, and that's what we're doing meeting during lobby day, by the way, and I know the date for lobby day is March 24th. So we'll be here in Sacramento talking to legislators and their staff on March 24th. If you can join our effort, please do. You know, this is a time we will set up meetings for you in lobby day. I guess I should just go ahead and talk about it. So March 24th, lobby day in Sacramento, and there's a training session in the morning, and then in the afternoon, you will join a team to go meet with legislators and their staff. And everybody's going to be polite, okay? When you're meeting with them, your team leader will be somebody who's had experience doing this so many times, like Roger, now Rick, and myself. And we will, in fact, guide you through the process. Nobody is asked to go in alone, and we actually ask you not to go in alone from lobby day. Oh, Ellie, welcome, welcome. I see you now. I didn't see you earlier. So we're talking about lobby day right now. Ellie has, she's the president of the Axel Board of Directors, and she has been a lobby day many years, and we appreciate that, Ellie. Thank you so much. And in fact, she's a team leader. So Roger, Ellie, and I, and we're trying to persuade Rick he's ready to be a team leader this year. We'll see how that comes out. So anyway, lobby day is really, really important. I swear every person who's ever participated in lobby day has in fact said that was a very empowering experience. I mean, think about it. You can actually go talk to a legislator or their senior staff, and they have to listen to you. If nothing else, that should be empowering right there. Oh, by the way, we feed you well. There's a free lunch involved in lobby day, and we make it as fun as possible. So join us if you can. Okay, so I want to ask one more time if anybody has anything to say about this bill, H.R. 7453. As I said, it was introduced on February 9. It's been referred to two committees, and therefore there's no committee hearings that have been established yet. As soon as there are, we'll tell you about it on the Axel website, and then we'll ask you to engage by, in fact, making sure that you communicate with the members of those committees. All right. Oh, yeah. Oh, Marty, too. Thank you, of course. Marty Weiss, who was with us earlier in this meeting, has also been a team leader and done a fabulous job. So you will have support during lobby day. And yeah. And, you know, we've been doing this at least 10 years. And, you know, just we have had results. I mean, I remember the first time it was like just, you know, Frank and I, Frank Lindsay and I, who went into the state legislature, and we started meetings and that. And one person was not happy that we were there. She was a legislator. She wasn't happy that we were there. And she basically said, how dare you? And then she proceeded to tell us how, when she was the mayor of a town, that in fact she had made sure that an ordinance got passed. It basically meant that most of that city was off limits to registrants. And this is how I received the message. Oh, we need to sue that city. And guess what? We did. And guess what? They no longer have those residency restrictions. Okay. So that's an outlier type of meeting for sure. But the fact is, many times you get very valuable information in these meetings. Here's another one, much more positive. And Senator Scott Wiener, who indeed was the author of the tiered registry law here in California, during lobby day, he told one of the teams that he had a bill that he wanted us to support. And when the team leader came back, and by the way, the team leader is a board member, and said that somebody wanted us to support a bill, I said, surely you'd heard that wrong. Nobody ever wants us to support legislation. And he said, no, that's really what they said. So I followed up with a phone call to that person that he met with, and he was right. And guess what? We did help Senator Wiener, and we got that passed, Senate Bill 145. And it was a really important bill for members of their LGBTQ community. And it did get passed. Yeah. So some very positive things happened during lobby day. Dan, you have your hand up? I'm going to unmute you or ask you to unmute yourself. There you go. How can we help you today, Dan?
Janice, I just wanted to make some comments on the House resolution.
Please.
I'm glad that you clarified that persona, yes, if it becomes the law of the land, so to speak. Once convicted, then you're ineligible for Medicaid. I did ask some questions, though. I mean, how does Medicaid differ from Medicare?
I have to admit, I don't know. Okay. Isn't Medicare for people who are 65 or older, I think?
Medicare is for people 65 or older. I don't know if that falls in it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think your question is, does this bill, if it were passed into law, would it affect Medicare? And I think the answer is no, but that's as it is currently written. It could be changed, and he could, in fact, easily add that as well.
Okay. And then a couple, and when they make the comment that, you know, federally funded or medical assistance at the federal level, that kind of spills over into, I think, maybe Veterans Administration care and those of us who are veterans that are on TRICARE, for instance.
Dan, I don't know. Legislation is, if you ever read it, it's sometimes hard to understand what they're really trying to do. But the only thing that I see here is Medicaid. And then, and also, by the way, I read his press release. He only mentions Medicaid. He doesn't mention Medicare and doesn't mention veterans. Okay. The only other thing he mentions is an IRS code. So that he's basically saying as well, you could not get Medicaid, but as well, some provision of the IRS code where people can write off their medical expenses that you would no longer be able to do that.
Okay. Serious unintended consequences, ripple effect out of here on this thing. So I'm concerned. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm concerned as well. Trust me, folks, we're going to be following this bill and we're going to be doing our best to stop it, but we're going to need your help to stop it. Bob, you have your hand up now, sir?
I do. I am on Medicaid, so I know the difference. I have support in-home services instead of going to a nursing, which is cost-effective by staying in the home and not going to a nursing home, if that makes any sense. They don't have to house me for $6,000 a month. But it's that extra, it's the difference that Medicare doesn't cover, set 20% usually, but it's a contract with Medicare and a state, what they pay. Medicaid, if you're, if you get on the Medicare savings program, that pays your medical benefit of the Medicaid, if that makes sense. So Medicaid takes care of that. So in my case, they would delete that, but they'd also delete my in-home care. I don't move very well, and I would lose my services. I'd lose all of my support wherever I go, to church or to out to the store or to visit friends. I'd have none of that.
Yeah, I understand, Bob, what you're saying, and I'm really glad that you're explaining this to us. And trust me, we're going to fight like bloody hell to stop this, okay? So we're taking this very seriously. And folks, think about this. There are at least, there are about 1 million people on the registry nationwide. 1 million people. That's not just, and then guess what? People on the registry have friends, they have family and stuff like that. And if we need to, this is a time to, we're going to flex our muscle, political muscle. I mean, we cannot let this become law. And you know, I know I said earlier, maybe this member of Congress was sexually assaulted himself, I mean, you know, and prior in his life. If so, I, you know, have great compassion for him. But the fact is, nobody should be doing this stuff. And I'm really concerned that, in fact, the, you know, the shadow, the Epstein shadow is influencing members of the, you know, of the legislature to do this kind of stuff. And I'm going to try not to swear, but I can't promise you I won't, because it's just bullshit. Okay, it is. Why? Why this is unconscionable? It's inhumane. Why in the world would you take away medical benefits from some of the people who need it the most, right? And it's, and why would you discriminate against any group? You know, why is it? It used to be, you know, well, suppose, okay, so we can talk about other groups of people who are protected, right? And I'm glad they're protected. Members of the LGBTQ community, African-Americans, you know, all there's groups of protected people. Registrants are not a protected class, okay? And so I think that gives people like this congressman some thought that he can just do this and there won't be any consequences for him. But we have to make sure he understands that there will be consequences, and yeah, and we have to stop the bill. So we are on top of this. We are reaching out to other organizations as well, because we are who we are, and we have limited resources like everybody else. But there's other organizations out there as well, and we're talking to them, Florida Action Committee, NARSOL, and the like. We're talking to them too about getting them energized to make sure that they weigh in as well, especially Florida Action Committee. This is a member of Congress, Florida, for goodness sake, right? And I already know one of the people who's a constituent. He's actually on the board of the Florida Act Committee. And so he's mad as hell about it, as you can imagine. He's not on Medicaid himself. He's a relatively young person and healthy as well, but you never know, right? So we have to stop this from happening. And we have to be very vigilant too watching to see what other nonsense, and I'm being kind using that word, what other nonsense these members of Congress might come up with. Dan, you've got your hand up, sir?
Yes. Although this, the sponsor of the bill is one person, would it be also helpful to write our senators, the members of the two committees that are going to be reviewing this, as well as the president, who are all involved in the approval process?
You know, I wouldn't go that far yet, okay? And because the bill is not a Senate bill. If it were a Senate bill, I would say yes, but it's a House bill. Okay, so Congress has two houses, remember, the House of Representatives and the Senate. And right now, this bill is only in the House of Representatives. It's bigger. There's 435 members of the House of Representatives. But the fact is, that means there's more people here today in this meeting, as well as people who will listen to the recording and others to actually weigh in and let this congressman know he's got a really bad idea. And we're not going to let him get away with it. Okay. So what we're watching, you know, is he going to get any co-sponsors? That's an important thing to watch for. It is a Republican Congress right now. So the fact that he's a Republican makes it a little bit easier to get more positive attention for the bill. These are the things that we're watching and seeing. And because a lot of bills get introduced that don't become law. Please understand that. Right. But if you just let a bill like this be introduced and then move through the committee process, there's, you know, and nobody says there's anything wrong with it, then guess what? It's easier to get it passed. So we're not going to let it happen without a lot of voicing of opposition on our part. And that's why I said we're going to need you to be heard here. We're not quite at a critical point yet, but I think him hearing early on that there's a lot of people out here who are very upset about this and questioning why the heck he would do this in the first place, right? Why? Okay. Before we move on, does anybody else have anything they want to talk about HR 7453? So trust me, we'll keep you apprised. And by the way, folks, Roger's here in the meeting today. And I want you to know that when we send out notices, whether they're sent out by email or by text, whether and your comments on the website, that's Roger who does that, right? So I constant contact with Roger, even when he was overseas on vacation last year. And you know what? He gets the job done. He does a fabulous job. And I really appreciate you, Roger. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Janice. And just one note to everybody, if you're not on our email alerts, just go to any page on our website and put your email address over there. You'll see the spot. If you put it in there and you're not receiving our emails, please contact me. I'll put my email in the chat window and say, hey, what's wrong? Because sometimes, like we found a problem with MSN blocking us, we might have a problem that we can help you resolve. So please contact me if you're not receiving the emails. And if you're not, please join us. Keep informed. Thanks.
Thank you, Roger. Okay, so I want to make a minor correction. Somebody in the chat room said that Congressman Stuby is the sponsor of the bill. He's not the sponsor of the bill. He's the author of the bill. Okay. A sponsor would be somebody who's not a member of Congress. So I just want to make that small correction. Okay. So let's talk about something else that we've been involved in a long time. I swear that I think this is a lawsuit that's never going to end. And what I'm talking about is the pending lawsuit, what it has to do with the Halloween signs in the state of Missouri. So we wanted the trial court level, then we won at the appellate court level with Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and now the Attorney General of Missouri is threatening to take this case to the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think there's a chance in heck that that's going to happen. The U.S. Supreme Court's going to want to grant review of this case. As much as I want to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't think this is it, but we'll see. Strange things are happening with the Supreme Court. I happen to be very happy today because of something they did yesterday. We don't need to go into that, but the fact is that you never know for sure. But it's a great delay tactic for the Attorney General of Missouri to use. And so we'll see, you know, we'll see what happens next. As I said, we've won at every level at the, you know, for this lawsuit. This district court basically ruled that this Halloween sign requirement is unconstitutional. I mean, without any limitation, that it's unconstitutional. And the trial court then issued a TRO and then a preliminary injunction a permanent injunction. So in fact, the state of Missouri cannot enforce this law that's on the books. So we shall see what happens next, but I just wanted to let you know. And actually the thing that we're fighting about now, believe it or not, is attorney's fees. By the way, the attorney's fees go to the organization, not to me or my law firm. We would really like to get those attorney's fees. And right now, this is how we found out from the attorney general's office that they're planning to file a request for review with the U.S. Supreme Court is because of attorney's fees. And they've said, oh, don't grant them attorney's fees. After all, we're going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you never know what the court might do. Maybe they'll say that this Halloween sign requirement is just fine. So, folks, I just want you to know that we really care a lot about these Halloween signs. If, in fact, there's a Halloween sign law in your state, please let us know because we will come and attack it. We can do that in federal court. And I'm only licensed in California, but I can practice law in any federal court, provided that I can find a local attorney to sponsor me. And that's usually not difficult. So, again, please be our eyes and ears. And if there's any other location that you know that has a requirement that a registrant post a sign on their home on Halloween, let us know and we will come and challenge it. Yeah. So I mentioned the SORNA litigation that's pending right now. For one more time, the court has changed the hearing date. In case you're following this, the new hearing date is March 30. So let's talk about the case itself. It's very important for a number of reasons, including the fact that what's one of the things that's being debated here is what is the definition of a sex offender? And again, a term I don't like to use, but that's the term in the law. And the federal government thinks it's anybody who has ever been convicted of a sex offense. And we disagree very strongly with that. And so we're waiting for this decision by the the trial court judge. And it has to do with cross motions for summary judgment. And what that basically means is both parties have filed a motion for summary judgment in the case. And the court actually doesn't even need to have a hearing. The judge can make a decision without a hearing, but for whatever reason keeps delaying it. So it's been about a year now. Since all the legal briefs were filed in these motions for summary judgment, and we're still waiting for a hearing. So I have no idea why a judge is waiting so much. I don't know, Ellie, who's like, criminal defense attorney, maybe you have some experience with this, but you know, in the 40 plus years I've been practicing law, I've never seen this happen. How about you, Ellie? And you're muted, Ellie. You're still muted.
Allowing.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, thank you. I've never practiced in federal court, but I did ask somebody who did, and apparently federal judges do what they want when they want. But what they want.
Yeah, the interesting thing is they don't have deadlines. Right. So they give attorneys, we have all kinds of deadlines when we're in federal court. Some attorneys refuse to practice in federal court because of that, because of all the crazy deadlines and rules that they have. But anyway, yet the judges themselves don't have deadlines and they can do practically anything they want. Oh, by the way, why is the one reason? Because they have lifetime appointment. Okay. So that's what's going on in SORNA. Again, the hearing is March 30th. There's information on the Axel website. We keep updating the articles. Actually, that's Roger doing it. And letting you know too that if and when there is a hearing, you can access it online. So you don't have to go to Riverside, Ellie. I think it's in Riverside. You don't have to go to Riverside. It's out in the desert here in California. You can, in fact, watch it at home. That's what I plan to do because the first couple of times I would have to fly there and I made flight arrangements only to have to undo them. So I'm not going to do that anymore. I'll just be watching it on the video. Okay, so let's move on. Oh, did see. The DC Vigil, March 7th. I mentioned it before, but it bears repeating. So Roger and I and other people are going to go to Washington, D.C., and we're going to be there on Saturday, March 7th. Please join us if you can. It's a fabulous experience. We will be near the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court, and we will be telling the court why they made a bad decision way back in 2003. So in case you don't know about the case, it's called Smith versus Doe. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled that being on the registry is not punishment. I hope that sinks in. Like, being required to register is not punishment? What the hell are you talking about? To make matters even worse, the U.S. Supreme Court, part of it, what it relied upon was an article in Psychology Today magazine, right? It was an article in Psychology Today magazine, and it was a marketing statement. It wasn't even, I've done 20 years of research and here's what I found. It wasn't that at all. It was one person, one psychologist who basically said, the reoffense rate is frightening and high. He used that term. And by the way, the U.S. Supreme Court picked it up and it's up to 80%. The reoffense rate. It's total nonsense. Those are not fact. Those are somebody else's opinion. And again, part of a marketing statement. And the thing is, the reason he made that statement, next thing he said was, oh, but if they come to me for counseling, I can cut that in half. So anyway, someday the U.S. Supreme Court will overturn this decision. They have made other stupid decisions in the past. I always think about Korematsu with a K. In Korematsu, the U.S. Supreme Court said it was just fine to put people of Japanese descent, Americans of Japanese descent, in internment camp. And the reason that one is so near to my heart and dear to my heart is because my roommate in law school, both of her parents were of Japanese descent, as was she, but both of her parents were put in internment camp. And I don't know about you, but that just is horrifying to me. It's just horrifying. So again, U.S. Supreme Court's made bad decisions in the past, and the fact is they need to correct their decision. By the way, there's one central player in this case as well, and it's John Roberts. So John Roberts, who is currently the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, he was the attorney in this case representing the government. And he said that being on the registry is like being a member of Price Club, Costco, Sam's Club, you know, all those big box stores and stuff. He said it's like being a member of one of those stores. And you know what? My best guess is John Roberts has never been in any of those stores, right? He's never been a member of any of those things. And he sure as hell has not been on the registry, or he would have lost his legal license. Okay. So this is the kind of nonsense, also known as bullshit, that this case is relying upon. And you know what? When there's such intellectual dishonesty in a decision, we know someday it's going to come down. I hope and pray, by the way, that I will be able to argue this case before the U.S. Supreme Court. I have gotten myself admitted to their Bar Association, which means I could. I have the right, you know, ticket to do that. Whether or not I actually get the opportunity in a case remains to be seen. But just understand that it's so important. And that's why Roger and I think this is the fourth year we've gone to Washington, D.C. to let John Roberts know what a mistake he made. And guess what? He's in a perfect position to clean up his mistake, right? He's a Chief Justice. So if they wanted to take a case, you know, for something like this, they could, if they want to review a decision. So we'll see. And by the way, another possibility of a decision is the SORNA case. So we think whatever happens in SORNA, and this is still at the trial court level, it will be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the middle level in federal courts. And then I'm sure whoever loses that battle, they're going to try to take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they have a decent chance of doing it. Okay. It's because the issue is much larger than people on the registry. By the way, the litigators in the case is a Pacific Legal Foundation, much larger organization than ours. They have 50 plus attorneys on their staff. I'm so jealous. 50 plus attorneys. By the way, they have taken many cases up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The last number I heard was 17 cases where they have litigated before the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've won 14 out of the 17. That's a damn good record. And so they're on our side. And by the way, Axol is a plaintiff in the lawsuit. We have several people who are individuals who are plaintiffs in the lawsuit as well, but we're in good hands. And so we're going to continue following the SORNA regulations case and let you know certainly as it develops. So in the trial court judge in that case, just if you don't already know, he issued a preliminary injunction in the case that basically said that these SORNA regulations do not apply to any registrant in the state of California. I wish he'd been braver, right? Had more courage, and that he applied that nationwide. But anyway, the people in California are certainly benefiting from the fact that he issued this preliminary injunction. And so what he's saying is people in California who are on the registry currently, and oh, by the way, anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense and lives in California is not affected by these SORNA regulations. So it's a very positive thing. All right, let's talk about something else, Section 8 housing. So I bring this up every month, I think, and it's for a good reason. The federal government basically defines who is qualified to either obtain Section 8 housing or even to live in somebody else's Section 8 housing. And they have for a very long time, they've excluded anybody who's on a lifetime registry. Well, guess what? In California, it used to be everybody on the registry was on for life, right? And so because of that, they were not eligible to obtain or even to live in somebody else's Section 8 housing. That changed when we got a tiered registry law for some people, not for everybody. But if you're in California and you have, oh, actually, this since it's nationwide, it's for anybody. If you're if you, well, California, and then I'll expand. If you're in California and you're on tier one or tier two, you're no longer required to register for life, and therefore you are eligible for Section 8 housing. I helped a man just this past week with that. And so what I do is I write a legal memo about it and say, hey, federal government, maybe you don't know, but the law in California has changed, and these people are no longer required to register for lifetime, and therefore they qualify for Section 8 housing. I've been able to help a lot of people with that. And folks, if you live even in another state and you're not on the registry, your registry for life, contact me, and maybe, boy, there's so many messages today, Roger. Maybe you can put my contact information in once again, because I think we still have new people joining us. Contact me, and I will write a memo for you as well. They're working, so I mean, I don't get angry about this. We just have federal government officials who don't know what's going on in the states, and so we're here to educate them. Okay, Section 8 housing. So let's talk about travel. But actually, before travel, let's talk about what's going on in some other states. So I'm constantly talking about cases in California, but I wanted to let you know that there are three cases. One of them has been decided already, and two cases are pending that involve registrants and that are important. One, the Pennsylvania case, it was appealed to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And guess what? It was ruled in favor of people on the registry, as well as other people who have criminal records. So in Pennsylvania, again, there's a state law, the Third Circuit said, hey, workers, that state law should protect workers who have criminal records. So in other words, they can't be, the employers can't discriminate against you in Pennsylvania anyway. And I guess the other states from within the third district here, third circuit rather, that in fact, just because you have a criminal record does not allow a potential employer to discriminate against you. So it's not almost, but not quite, a protected class. The other two states I want to mention, West Virginia, there's an annual registration fee in West Virginia, and now it's being challenged. We don't have a registration fee in California, thank you God, but in other many states do. In some states, people have to register multiple times a year, and each and every time they have to pay the registration fee. So, and again, in West Virginia, there's a lawsuit pending that challenges the annual registration fee. I think that fee is $125 in West Virginia. Arizona, this is actually a newer case that has to do with internet restrictions, right? And I don't know how anybody can require somebody or restrict somebody from using the internet. It just boggles my mind. I mean, I do so many things on the internet. I would imagine you all do as well. And just imagine if somebody told you you can use the internet. I mean, a lot of times these days, people apply for jobs on the internet, right? And paper applications and paper resumes are almost extinct at this point in time, I've been told. So the fact is that in the state of Arizona, there's a challenge that has been filed here, basically saying these internet restrictions are in violation of the First Amendment. I know one of the attorneys who's working on the case, her name is Adele Nichols. Sometimes confuse her with the golfer, Nicholson. But anyway, Adele is a great attorney. She's in Illinois. She used to be a member of our board of directors, and now she is in Illinois on their organization and on their board of directors. She works with registrants quite a bit, and she does a fabulous job. So please understand that's going on in Arizona, even though she's in Illinois, but it's in federal court. So just like me going to Missouri, we can always go to another state in federal court if we can find a local attorney to sponsor it. Okay, so I want to bring those things up because, again, sometimes we don't mention what's going on in the other states, and I wanted you to know about these three cases. So let's talk about travel, domestic travel, and also international travel. So domestic travel, believe it or not, is more complicated than overseas travel. I'm not saying that there are no problems with overseas travel. Exactly, it's the opposite. But the fact is, with domestic travel, you're dealing with laws in 50 different states. Okay, and note there, every state has its own registration laws. Who has to register? When do they have to register? Et cetera, et cetera. So you just, if you're going to travel domestically, and this is regardless of whether you're currently required to register or not, by the way, even if you've gotten off the registry in your home state, it still is complicated. Okay. So let's just talk about the different states. Like before I mention the other states, I want to mention the District of Columbia. If you want to go visit Washington, D.C., guess what? There's no limitation on how long you can stay there as a visitor. If you move there, that's different. But if you go there as a visitor, you don't have to register regardless of how long you stay. You want to take a 30-day vacation to Washington, D.C.? Swell, go ahead. And no, you don't have to register. You don't. I've talked to the Washington, D.C. Many times about this. By the way, what they say to me is, oh, we'd really like that person to contact us and let us know they're there. And then I ask, is that a requirement? No. So guess what my advice has always been? Don't make a phone call. Don't let the registration office in D.C. know that you're there. There's no requirement to do it, and therefore just don't do it. But let's talk about the states. Rhode Island is 24 hours. If you stay in Rhode Island more than 24 hours, you're going to have to register there, okay? On the other end of the spectrum is Hawaii. And Hawaii is 10 days, okay? If you stay in Hawaii more than 10 days on a single visit, you're going to have to register. And all the other states are in between. Okay, so like California, if you want to come visit California, you can stay for 5 business days in California without having to register. So for example, that would mean if you came to California on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday do not count, and you could be here until Friday and then leave, okay, without having to figure in the requirement to register. So there are other states, though, it's calendar days, so I warn you, and some states like Nevada, it's the number of hours. So if you want to go visit the state of Nevada, the limit is 48 hours, okay? And yes, I mean the state of Nevada. So if you want to go to Reno, if you want to go to Las Vegas, it's 48 hours total, okay? So people tell me, well, I went to Las Vegas for a whole week and nothing happened. And oh, they didn't register. And I said, I'm happy for you. Okay, there are people who run red lights who don't get tickets too. But do you really want to risk it? Some people who run a red light, they get caught by the police, or worse yet, they're involved in a serious accident. So the same thing with this, if you trigger the requirement to register in a state and you don't register in that state, guess what? That could be a failure to register right there and then. You could end up being charged with and convicted of a sex offense in another state, right, that you're visiting, and end up in jail or prison. I don't think you want to do that. And also, when I talk about overseas travel, it affects overseas travel as well. And I'll tell you why in a minute, but we're still talking about domestic right now. So just plan carefully when you're going to go visit another state. By the way, we have on our website, we have a chart that was created by somebody else, not by Axel, but his information seems to be accurate as to what, you know, what are the registration requirements in every state. It's mind-boggling. I will mention, and you say, well, I really have to go to Florida. Okay. Florida is a terrible state and is to be avoided if you're on the registry, if at all possible. Okay. They treat people on the registry very poorly there. And the thing is, you might trigger a requirement too, not just to register there, but also you have to sign up with the DMV for some reason. Those are state law. Okay. And the worst thing about Florida is if you register in Florida, they will never take you off the registry. Think about that. Never take you off the registry. It's been challenged in court. So the family members of somebody who died and he was on the Florida registry filed a lawsuit in Florida to take his name off. He was dead, and the state of Florida refused to do that. So think about it. Dead people are in the Florida register. Many people on the Florida registry don't live there. Okay, they just went to visit. They went to Disney World. They went to, I don't know, Universal Studios, whatever they did. Come to California, folks. You can stay here for a long time. All right, don't go to Florida. And I mean it. And I'm not here for the Chamber of Commerce of California. I'm just telling you that if you're on the registry, you really should avoid Florida if at all possible. I know sometimes, folks, it's not possible. So sometimes you have a parent who lives in Florida in a retirement home or whatever, and you want to be there, you know, when they're in their last days or something like that. Situation like that, well, maybe it's worth it. But just don't go there for entertainment, please. Just for entertainment. It's not worth it. That's just my point of view. Okay. So let's talk about, remember I said, regardless of whether or not you're currently required to register in the state where you're convicted, because some of the state laws actually include people who, in their requirement to register, people who are no longer required to register in the state where they were convicted. I think that's terrible, but that's what some of these laws say. And by the way, there's an easy way to deal with domestic travel and a much more difficult and financially painful way to do it. So what I mean by that is if you're no longer required to register and you want to visit a state, you can just act as if you were still on the registry. Okay, so like Nevada, 48 hours. Even if you're no longer required to register, you might just decide that you're going to just spend 48 hours there. You don't have to necessarily. I really don't know what the laws are in Nevada, but I will certainly refer you to a Nevada attorney. And by the way, I have a lot of attorney referrals, so almost every state, but not quite every state covered at this point in time. So you just want to make sure that you know, that, okay. So, but this is another way to approach it. If there's a state that you go to on a regular basis, or you want to go on a regular basis, then I think it might pay literally for you to actually hire an attorney in that state, and they can do the research for you. Okay. So, you know, maybe your parents live in a state, or maybe your cousins, or maybe your best friend, you know, lives in another state. You want to know how long can you stay there? Again, these are for people who are no longer required to register. It probably is worthwhile to go ahead and find out, you know, whether or not you'd have to register there. And folks, it's the reason this is so complicated is some of the laws basically say, well, if you're convicted of this offense or that offense, you know, 17 offenses, then you'll have to register here. But then you're in the state where you're convicted, the offenses are different. They have different names. They have all these other things. So that's why sometimes an attorney has to look at the elements of the offense and whatever you're convicted of, compare them to the elements of those 17 offenses that are listed in the other state you want to visit. So it can be very complicated to do this. But again, maybe, you know, if in fact you visit a location on a regular basis, then maybe it makes sense to go ahead and pay an attorney to set for you. Okay. By the way, I'm going to take a break after I talk about overseas. And Ellie, if you're listening, maybe you can be ready to spell me at that time, if she's still available. Okay, so let's talk about overseas travel. There's something called the International Megan's Law. Okay, it was passed by Congress back in 2015, as I recall. And President Obama signed the bill into law. I liked Obama a lot. And this is one of the things he did that was really upsetting to me, that he signed this law. There was a lot of momentum behind the law. And basically it says, if you're, quote, a covered sex offender, and then you're going to have to do two things. One, you're going to have to notify the office where you register at least 21 days before you travel overseas. And number two, you're going to have a unique identifier added to passport. So those two things, those two requirements are very upsetting to me, and I'm not required to register. The second one is more than upsetting. I'll think of an adjective in a minute. Okay, so let's talk about the first requirement. Well, let's talk about the definition of covered sex offender. So under the International Megan's Law, you're a covered sex offender if, in fact, you're convicted of a sex offense that involves a minor. The definition of minor is a federal definition, which is 18. So even though if your state defines the age of consent is 16 or 17, federal government, they don't care. If your offense involves somebody under the age of 18, then you're a covered sex offender. Okay. Oh, by the way, it can be viewing child pornography too. I like to call it illegal images. So if you're looking at pictures of a 16-year-old, a nude 16-year-old, that unfortunately qualifies here and would qualify you as a sex offender, covered sex offender under the International Megan's Law. Okay, so again, if you're a covered sex offender, you have to give advance notice at least 21 days before you go overseas. By the way, the two pieces of critical information are, when are you departing and when are you returning? And they want to know precisely what day, what time, what flight number, what airline, all that other stuff. Okay, but you don't necessarily have to tell them, well, first I'm going to go to France, and then I'm going to go to Spain, and then I'm going to go to the Netherlands. You don't have to do that. Okay, what you just have to tell them when you're departing and when you're returning. Okay, so that's that part of the International Megan's Law. The other part is the part that really is upsetting to me. I mean, down to my core, it's upsetting because it basically is putting a scarlet letter on your passport, right? And I, by the way, I challenged this law soon after it passed, very soon after it passed. And one of the arguments I made was that there are only two states in the history of the world that have ever done this to the passports of their citizens. The first was Nazi Germany. And for their Jewish citizens, they put a big red J on their passport. And the other one was the USSR. And they also identified their Jewish citizens on their passport. That's the only two countries in the whole world that have ever done that. And I said to the judge, and I still believe it, we do not want to be a member of that club. But yet we are because of the unique identifier. Okay. So the unique identifier, what it says under the tiered the International Megan's Law, it says that if you're a covered sex offender, the State Department can revoke your passport at any time they want, but without notice, by the way, number one. And then number two, they can, when they issue you a new passport, they are supposed to put this unique identifier on your passport. That's bad enough. But here's worse. Now the State Department is saying, you have to identify that you are a covered sex offender when you apply for a passport, and you have to request that the unique identifier be added to your passport. That just makes me popping mad. It says, oh yes, I'm a Jew, and I'm not really Jewish, but I'm a Jew in Nazi Germany, and I want you to put that big red fat J on my passport. Nonsense. Utter nonsense. So, but this is a problem if you don't have a unique identifier on your passport. This is an outlier. This case I'm going to tell you about is an outlier, but this is something that actually happened. So one of my clients who consulted with me ahead of his travel overseas, he and his wife basically checked their bags. And it happened in Los Angeles Airport. They checked their bags. They were sitting in their seat, ready, waiting for the plane to take off, when he got tapped on the shoulder. And this person who was an employee of the Department of Homeland Security said, "You have to get off the plane." And then my client said, "Why?" And he said, "You don't have a passport." And he pulls the passport out of his pocket of his jacket and says, "Yes, I do." And the man took it from him. And he goes, "No, your passport's been revoked." So that man did not go to Europe. He had a 3-week vacation planned, and he had people and loved ones waiting for him and his wife in Europe, and they never made it. Okay. So this is as terrible as it is. I do recommend to people that when you apply for a new passport, you request a unique identifier so something like that doesn't happen to you. I mean, it's up to you. You can travel. It's just like in Las Vegas. You want to stay a week in Las Vegas, hopefully you don't get shot or you're not involved in a car accident, you know, where somebody basically finds out who you are and you haven't registered. But the fact is that if you don't have a unique identifier on your passport, you're a covered sex offender, and not everybody is who's on the registry, then at least there's this possibility that in fact that your passport can be revoked at any time. So one of the reasons we say over and over again, we recommend that you not register in more than one state, has to do with the International Megan's Law. Because I'm sorry, there's two parts to it. You're a covered sex offender and you're registered in at least one state. So if you're not registered, okay, Californians and other states too, they have people getting off the registry. If you're not registered in any state, guess what? You're not a covered sex offender. And I rescued this one poor man who was already living overseas. And he went to another country for business. He was living in country A. He went to country B on business, and his passport was revoked. And trust me, I screamed like bloody hell, and so did he. And he said, no, I am not registered in any state. They had sent a letter to his parents' house. His parents, it was the state of Virginia, by the way, his parents' house in Virginia, they sent a letter saying that they had revoked his passport, but they couldn't revoke his passport because he didn't register in Virginia. He hadn't registered in Virginia for at least 5 years. I mean, it was on and on and on. So I was able to persuade the Department of Homeland Security, or actually the State Department in that case, that in fact they had improperly revoked his passport. So, but he spent like an extra 5 days or something in that second country while the passport issue got worked out. And thank God he knew about me and I was able to help him. So folks, don't register in more than one state if you can avoid it. That's the bottom line. And by the way, in addition to Florida, the state of New York is the same way. So in the state of New York holds on to people for next to forever. Okay, so 73 new messages. Goodness, a lot of chatting going on. And I can't read them because I'm talking. So we're going to talk about the tiered registry in California in a few minutes. Ellie, if you want to warm up your voice here. But first, I want to talk about the fact. What's that, Ellie? Your computer's not working? No? Oh.
It's just okay. So you know, I've been unmuted.
Roger, stop talking. I want to hear what Ellie has to say. Ellie, please.
Roger, ask Roger to say what something's happening and Roger's taking care of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Potential Zoom bomber that was taking care of something. So I disabled people's ability to unmute or turn on their video temporarily. A guy came in with no shirt and started doing stuff.
Thank you, Roger. Wow. This is a new one, an experience of being Zoom bombed. Really, in the history of doing this, folks, this is the only time we've gotten a Zoom bomber on a monthly meeting like this. One time, myself and another attorney, and it wasn't Ellie, we were doing a webinar, and it was worse than that. Somebody started playing a video of two people having sex. we've gotten better at security since then. And Roger, I'm so glad you're here today. And you stopped that. Okay, so Ellie, I think you're going to be able to talk in just a minute. Okay.
Should we call that person a Zoom streaker?
There you go.
Didn't have a shirt on?
We'll have to come up with new terms here. Hopefully, yeah, who knows if he was wearing anything else. Okay, so yeah, life is always fun when you're on the registry, right? Okay, so let's talk about, folks, I just remember I talked about some cases outside of California. Let me talk about the fact that we filed three lawsuits in 30 days in California. So that doesn't happen very often. In fact, I can't even remember any time it's ever happened in my career, but 30 lawsuits in 30 days. So the biggest lawsuit that we filed has to do with the Department of Correction. I challenged the Department of Corrections a lot in California, and I've won every case so far. They lately, they've changed their tune. It used to be that they just yawned that I sued them one more time. And then we went through the whole court process and then they lost. But the last two cases before this one, they basically, when I sued them, they said, let's settle the case. Let's settle the case. I don't know what they're going to do with this one, but this one, again, it pisses me off. And I'll tell you why. Because we had a prior lawsuit against them that had to do with an illegal policy. They were breaking the law. Our Department of Corrections was breaking the law. Isn't that interesting, right? They broke the law. The Department of Correction. And they broke the law by doing the following. They were requiring every single registrant the entire time they're on parole to undergo treatment. And the law says, the state law says something completely different, right? And they had this policy and they thought it was just swell. And they even told a trial court judge that they had this policy and they didn't even try to hide it, which really surprised me. So anyway, and then I filed a second lawsuit. That was one person. And I filed a second lawsuit for multiple people. And they said, oops. Okay, you caught us doing it again. So tell you what, let's settle the case. And the way that the case got settled is the Department of Corrections issued regulations, new regulations about treatment. Okay, and the regulations themselves were reasonable. So we agreed to settle the case because of these new regulations. Well, two of the things that the regulations say they have to do, one is they have to allow people to go to their own containment meetings. I don't know how many of you all been to a containment meeting, but you have to go to your containment meeting. And number two, after the containment meeting, if the department decides you need more treatment, they have to put their reason for that decision in writing. And there's a form. CDCR loves forms. So good old CDCR form 3043, they must give it to the person, to the registrant, within 30 days of the containment meeting. It's just spelled out like that. It's that clear in the regulation. Well, guess what? They're not doing it. They're not doing it. And I've gotten so many phone calls and emails and everything else from people telling me that this isn't being done. But you know what? For almost a year, nobody was willing to be a plaintiff in our lawsuit. Nobody. Until finally somebody stepped forward and said, yeah, I'm going to do it. Because indeed, you know, it was last December. He had a containment meeting. Oh, he wasn't allowed to attend his own containment meeting. And then on top of that, when, you know, I told him about this form, he went and requested the form a couple of times and they never gave it to him. So that's the lawsuit that we filed now. So that was number one. And I think, you know, again, to me, it's a really important lawsuit because we have over 7,000 people in California who are on parole, 7,000, and they are treating people so poorly. And I was like, I don't know what it's going to take to get their attention, but I'm just going to keep suing them until we have their attention. Okay, so that was one of the lawsuits. Another one involved a county, Fresno County. Fresno, in case you're not from California, is out in the desert. And Fresno County is not known for its being open-minded, just the opposite. And so they passed an ordinance that basically is going to make it really difficult for registrants to find housing in Fresno County. So the thing is, they came about it in a sneaky way. They didn't call it a residency restriction, but it really is a residency restriction. So it's basically making very difficult again for registrants to find housing in Fresno County. And the worst part about this county ordinance is this. They basically make people bounty hunt. So if you find out that somebody is violating this law, they can run to the county supervisors and let them know, and they can get a reward. I mean, really, they're become bounty hunters. And so I was like, I don't think so. We're not going to let you get away with that. So we filed a lawsuit challenging that county ordinance. By the way, we believe that county ordinance is preempted by state law, and you know, so we'll see. That's the basis for the lawsuit. It's been exciting for sure. And the last one had to do with another lawsuit against CDCR, a much more narrow scope, kind of sort of. It could be broader actually than the treatment, but this is the deal. So CDCR was basically saying that a victim at any time while a person was on parole could basically object to where they're living. Okay, that a person on parole, again, we're talking about more than 7,000 10,000 people, that the victim could say, that person can't live within 35 miles of me. And believe it or not, I mean, that's, if you put a pin in it and then you draw a big circle, 35 miles often means you can't be in the next county or maybe two counties over. Okay. So it's basically restricting significantly where a person on the registry and on parole, this if, only involves parolees, could live. So this particular situation, this man, our position is this, that parole could only do that one time, could only allow a victim to object to a person's residence one time, and that's when they're immediately released from prison or jail. And this man, it was his third residence after he was released from prison, his third residence. They gave him 24 hours notice, telling him he had to move from one county to another county, and only given 24 hours notice. He had started a successful business in the county, let's just call it County A, and he basically had to abandon his business because he had to go to County B. So we said, that's not right. And that's what this lawsuit is about. So again, we filed three lawsuits in 30 days, and we know it's going to have the potential to help a lot of people in California who are on the registry and some of the people who are on parole as well. So, Ellie, I think it's time to talk about the tiered registry. Would you please take the lead?
Yes, thank you, Janice. Okay, so I'm going to talk about getting off the tiered registry in California because this law applies to Californians. And Dave, I see your new name on your video is Dave off the registry. Congratulations. It is not automatic. I saw a question in the chat, and that chat was about the California registry and being able to terminate registration. It is not automatic. It must be done through the courts because there's a judge who will look over the petition and the prosecutor will be allowed to weigh in. So in California, there are forms and there's a website called California Court Forms, and the forms are right on the website. Janice and I probably would recommend that somebody who seeks to get off the registry would probably need a lawyer. There are some lawyers like myself who do it for free. Janice will charge a fee for doing it. But in California, there's now three tiers of registration. There is tier one, tier two, and tier three. The registration time for somebody on tier one is 10 years. Those are mostly for misdemeanors. The registration for someone in tier two is 20 years, and tier three, unfortunately, still has lifetime registration. And I'm sure on lobby day, that's one issue we may discuss with the legislatures, some type of off-ramp for people who are still on lifetime registration. One of the first forms that you need to obtain from the police agency where you register is the proof of current registration. And that is attached to the petition, and that just shows the court and the prosecutor that you are in compliance with your current registration. Sometimes if somebody picks up a new case or a failure to register, there is time added, I think, for a misdemeanor failure to register. If somebody were in tier one, instead of 10 years, it might be 11 years. If somebody picked up a new case and served time in prison, the time they are incarcerated does not count for registration time. So it just depends on, you know, the individual's specific situation. When somebody completes a petition to be removed from the registry, it has to be served or given or mailed to the police agency where the person registers. And if the conviction occurred in another town, it has to go to the police agency where the conviction occurred, the arresting agency, and then it gets served to the prosecutor where the individual lives, and it also gets served to where the original prosecution took place if it is there. If it took place, let's say the conviction happened in Orange County and then the person moved to Los Angeles, it would need to be served to the prosecutor in Orange County as well as the prosecutor in Los Angeles. Somebody just asked a question in the chat about whether or not this is state or federal. And right now I'm talking about California, but once in a while, there are people on the California registry who have a federal offense. And the Department of Justice then decides if the person moves to California and needs to register, the Department of Justice will determine in what tier they belong, because they look at the federal conviction and try to match it up with the California statute that is comparable. So it just depends what the federal conviction is. I've talked to some people who got convicted in federal court in Texas and then moves to California and finds himself in tier three. It just depends on what the statute is. But so that's, you know, is to be determined if somebody does have a federal conviction and then has to register in California. So it's up to the Department of Justice. And I'm sure Janice would be able to look at the tier assignment in case, you know, somebody thinks it's incorrect in that situation. Okay, so back to the petition. The petition then gets filed to the appropriate police agencies, the appropriate prosecutorial agencies, and then the court, you know, makes a decision. I know there's a lawyer on the board, Jeff Stein, who works out of San Luis Obispo. And he believes that if there are any supporting documents, like character references, letters from, you know, somebody's pastor, somebody's employer, those should go after the individual has filed their original petition. So I think everybody has their own unique system of filing the petition. And once the petition is filed, my guess is it takes anywhere from 30 to 60 days. Many times I think petitions are granted without a court hearing. But if there is a prosecutor who makes an objection, then the court will set a hearing date and the individual needs to show up at court, and there will be a hearing in regard to the petition. There's a lot of factors that I think are taken into consideration. Janice, you probably know better than I do in some of the factors that are considered, but the prosecutor has the burden of proof to show that if the petition is granted, the person, you know, won't be a threat to public safety.
Ellie, because folks, this is a really important thing that Ellie just said. So I want to repeat what she said, which is the district attorney in these petition cases, it is a district attorney and not the petitioner who has the burden of proof. All right. And initially I made that argument in cases and stuff, but it was kind of, let's say, an assertion on my part until two decisions in the last few years. So one of them is called People versus Franco and the other one's called People versus Ty. And both of those decisions, an appellate court said that right out loud so everybody could see it, right? And in fact, it's the DA's burden to prove that a person poses a current risk. And it's really hard for them to do it because guess what? They cannot require a person, a petitioner, to go get a risk assessment. Okay. So you can go get a risk assessment. And for my clients, if in fact the DA objects, and by the way, the DA objects to very few of the petitions these days because of these two cases. If the DA does object, I recommend strongly that my client go get a psychological evaluation done. And then we provide that information to the court if in fact it's favorable to the petitioner. Every single person I've sent to certain people, it's always been a positive assessment. And so we take it to the court and they don't have anything to rebut that. So when they, you know, when a counselor, a psychologist can say this person poses either a low risk of reoffense or a very low risk of reoffense, you're giving the judge like a shield to hide behind. And it's like, oh, look at this person here, the psychologist who knows about this, you know, and has in fact done a case by case study of this person, right? Then feels much more comfortable granting a petition. So please continue, Ellie.
Well, I was just about done. Thank you for adding that, Janice.
Sure.
Sometimes local public defender offices will be able to handle the petitions. when Janice talked about, you know, the psychological evaluation, risk assessment, those don't come cheap. So for low-income people, I don't know what the alternative would be. And I don't know if the public defender would be able to appoint an expert for the individual under, you know, and the individual would be paid under, you know, court funds. But I know that it's an important tool. But anyway, that's it in a nutshell. And, you know, I urge everyone that who is in either tier one or tier two to make a note of when the date for termination is approaching, because it's, like I said earlier, it's not automatic. You have to petition. And when I think Janice, you've attended KSON meetings where they give you the number of people who are on the registry, and not everybody's in tier three. So that means that there are people probably eligible to get off tier one or tier two. And you need to, you know, figure out if it's you, in what tier, and when you can get off, because life will be a lot better off the registry.
Absolutely. So the big picture that I see with the tiers, registration law, and the petitioning process, I usually tell people to expect it to take about 6 months. From 6 months from the time that the petition is filed until the judge makes a decision about your petition. Sometimes in some counties it can take less time, but if you just prepare yourself for 6 months, you might be pleasantly surprised if it only takes 4 months, right? And the reason it takes so long, folks, is that after the petition is filed, the law enforcement office where you register is going to make a decision about whether or not you're eligible. And then they'll share that they have up to 60 days to make that decision. They share that decision with the DA's office. They don't have to share it with us, unfortunately, okay? And then the next 60 days after that is when the DA's office makes a decision about whether or not to object to your petition. So I'm happy to report that at least 90% of the petitions that I have filed, no DA has not objected to the petition. Okay. If the DA objects, though, and some people do file their own petition, okay? There's the form that needs to be filled out. There's even instructions on how to fill out the form. It's a little more challenging to make sure everybody gets served properly and stuff, but some people can and will do it, okay? But guess what? Some people don't want to have to deal with it, and they're like, no, I have PTSD. I never want to go into another courtroom, whatever it is. And so hire a legal professional to do it for you. Hire Ellie, hire Jeff, hire me to do it. And we can help you navigate through the system here. So part of the big picture is, in fact, I think I just muted you, Roger, I'm sorry. Part of the big picture is this, that I said 6 months. The other thing is at least 90% of petitions, the DA does not object. If the DA does not object to your petition, guess what? There is no hearing. Okay. That's a good thing. It's all done on the papers. And the next thing you know, you'll be mailed a copy of the court decision granting your petition. But just in case you're in that unlucky 10%, then there will be a hearing. And even if you have filed your own petition, do not represent yourself in a hearing. This is an adversarial hearing, and the DA will come in with both guns blazing. I'm just telling you. Okay. So please, please, please don't represent yourself in a hearing. They'll pay if you want to do the paperwork. Many people don't want to bother with it, but in case you do your own paperwork, if the DA objects to your petition, please get legal counsel. Ben, you have your hand up. You have a question or a comment, Ben? I think you're trying to unmute yourself. I see it blinking. Let me click on it and see if it makes a difference. Okay. Ben, I don't know if you're on your phone or if you're doing something else. All right. Somebody has asked a question. Hopefully Ben can figure out how to unmute himself. Or maybe Roger, you can try to help Ben. Dan asked a question. Can you update on tier three registrants that technically should be on tier two? I think Ben is with us. Ben? No, somebody else. Okay. That technically should be on tier two due to mistake and how the registry was written. I'm not sure what that means. So Dan, you're still here. You want to speak to that? Because I'm not sure what your question is asking. We have more than one Dan, maybe. Dan, are you there?
Yeah. Jess, can you hear me?
Yes, I can now.
Oh, hi. Yeah. We spoke about this before, but there are registrants that are on the registry that have been put in a tier three when the same offense with somebody that was a year younger, 14 or under, is on tier two.
All right. Now I know what you're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just wondering, is there anything that we can do to help?
Yes, we can get the law changed. That's what we're going to require. So what Dan is specifically referring to, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, is people now who are convicted of Penal Code Section 288, parentheses A, that's lewd or lascivious acts with somebody under the age of 14. Those people convicted of that offense are assigned to Tier 2, and yet if, in fact, somebody did the same conduct with somebody who's 15 years old, actually 14 or 15, it's considered tier three. That makes no sense to me. I hope it doesn't make any sense to you either. If what we're worried about is children, and not just children, but young children, then why would you put somebody whose victim was older on the higher tier? So that's something that we have, in fact, been trying to persuade the legislature about for many years, and we're going to continue until they finally say yes. So, and it's not just us now, by the way, also the Sex Offender Management Board has agreed with us.
Correct. Yes.
And they've made a formal recommendation to the legislature to make that change. So what year it's going to happen, I don't know, but I'll tell you, I do believe absolutely that it will happen. So this is one of the things, folks, when you sign up, and Roger, you were talking earlier about how people can sign up for email messages and text messages, and you can check our website every day if you want, but just in case you don't have the time to check it every day, sign up for the alerts and everything, and then you'll know when in fact the law has changed. And this is, Dan, just so you know, this is one of our primary objectives in Lobby Day this year, is we're going again to the legislature and say, hey, this is what needs to be done, it needs to be done now, and that is to get
thank you so much Janice, appreciate you giving us hope.
Absolutely. And that's to get people convicted of 288C off of tier three and down to tier two. Okay. There's some other offenses too that we're requesting relief for. One of them is people convicted of possessing illegal images. That's what I prefer to call it, not child pornography, but illegal images. Okay. And for those people right now, they're on tier three. They're on the highest tier. What? That makes no sense. It's a non-contact, non-violent offense. Why in the heck are they on tier three? Oh, it's because of a political compromise. I don't need to go into the details of the political compromise, but when the tiered registry law was basically going through the legislative process, a person, very powerful person, made sure that people convicted of possessing illegal images were on tier three instead of tier one. So that is our recommendation to the legislature and what we will be asking them to do on March 24th. So I believe in being transparent, and I will just tell you this. I'm pessimistic about the legislature changing the law this year. And why is that? Number one, because it's an election year. Every time it's an election year, they become jellyfish. In other words, they can't find their spine, and they're afraid to do anything that's the least bit controversial. The other reason, quite frankly, this year too, is what I call that Epstein shadow, right? This Epstein shadow just keeps growing larger and larger. I just wish they'd rip the Band-Aid off, right? And this is not a political statement. It's just like, for gosh sakes, just get it over with. Whatever you have, federal government, let go of it. And let's all deal with it at the same time instead of, well, we're going to deal with really some here, we're going to release some there, blah, blah, blah. But I'm not so optimistic about this year. I am optimistic next year, because next year is not an election year. And in fact, they can, in fact, do things that are a little bit controversial. Okay. So next year, I think we have a better chance than this year at getting the tiered registry law changed. Having said that, it's still important that we conduct Lobby Day this year, because we need to remind the legislature of our issues and how darn important they are. So does anybody else have a question or a comment about that?
I just have a comment. This is somewhat unrelated, but actually it is related. If anybody has a conviction as a minor, as a juvenile, I just recently got a client who, as a juvenile, I think he was 14 years old, picked up a case that required registration. As an adult, he went to prison for a small chunk of time. So the 10-year period, I have to figure out if he has the 10 years. But juvenile adjudications can also require registration. And so that is important to note if you know anybody who was a minor at the time of his or her offense. The other thing, too, that I wanted to add is that in California, there is a term called a wobbler in the criminal justice system. And a wobbler is a crime that could be charged either as a misdemeanor or a felony. If somebody got probation on a wobbler, then it means that it's possible the judge will reduce or could reduce it to a misdemeanor. And that could change the tier assignment. But right now, there is a court case in the California Court of Appeal where somebody who had his conviction reduced to a misdemeanor tried to get it get off the registry after 10 years. And so that's the issue in that case. And so if the person had a wobbler and went to prison, it's going to be a felony forever. But with a wobbler and probation, the felony has an opportunity to get reduced to a misdemeanor, and it may result in a change of tier assignment, and therefore termination might be possible.
Yeah, thank you for that, Ellie. Somebody has asked a question here about an attempted offense. So somebody convicted of an attempted offense. That's a lawsuit that we filed, folks. And this time we sued the Department of Justice, not the Department of Corrections, and we won. And that case went the entire way through the court. So if you were indeed convicted of an attempted offense, and it should say Penal Code Section, I think it's 657 and then slash something else, then you were convicted of an attempted offense. It might, in fact, be able to lower your tier assignment. I say maybe because there's one big one that it's not going to affect, and that's 2A parentheses A. The way the tiered registry law is currently written, if you were convicted even of attempted 288A, you'll still be assigned to tier two. But on many other offenses, if it's an attempt, and even attempted rape, you can be, your tier assignment can be reduced for attempted rape from tier three down to tier two. And it doesn't solve all your problems, obviously. You'd still have to register for 20 years. But in fact, you would be eligible to petition for removal at some point. And folks, you know, and I know Ellie, you mentioned KSOM meeting. It was a couple of times ago, meetings ago, of KSOM, and one of the, I think it was the representative from the Department of Justice who said something I'd never heard before, which was that the government was expecting 30,000 people to file a petition in the first year after the tiered registry law became effective. 30,000 people. You know what? 30,000 people have not. Even here it is 4 years later, and people have still, that number has still not reached 30,000. In fact, it's about half that amount. So only about 15,000 people have filed petitions for removal. Folks, if you are eligible or you think you might be eligible, contact Ellie or contact me, and let's talk about it. I was able to help a man just this past week. He thought he wasn't eligible, and I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, you are eligible. You know, we got his petition filed last week. So he found out he was eligible. He got his 8050, the proof of current registration, and his petition was filed in 1 week's time. Okay. He's so ecstatic about that. And, you know, we're not going to tell you, I know Ellie's a straight shooter. I know I'm a straight shooter. So is Jeff Stein, by the way, who's not with us today, but we can help you figure out whether or not you're eligible to petition. And by the way, tier three, and Ellie, I'm sorry, I did go to the restroom while you were speaking. And I don't know if you mentioned this or not, but some people assigned to tier three are eligible to petition after 20 years. It's a small number of people, small percentage, but still, when you get your 8050 form, it will tell you, it says tier three, and if it says dash risk level, you are eligible to petition after 20 years, okay? Because that means you're assigned to tier three solely based upon your risk level, and therefore you are eligible to petition after 20 years. People, if it just says tier three, you're not, okay? But if it says tier three dash risk level, then you in fact are eligible to petition after 20 years. So that, I mean, that's, again, it may not help that many people, but it does help other people. I want as many people as possible to file their petitions now. And I'll tell you why. If you're eligible, file now. There is some legislation that's pending that could change things and make it more difficult to petition. These district attorneys are working everything they can to try to make it more difficult to file a petition or for your petition to be granted. I don't need to go into the hairy details right now, but trust me, it's going on behind the scenes and stuff. They know that they're in a bad place right now. It's really hard for them to win these petitions, I'm happy to report. So that's why they're objecting to so few of them. All right. And I'll just give you a few facts. I have filed 189 petitions as of today. And of the 189, 145 of them have been granted. That's one attorney, right? And I don't know. There's other people out there, obviously, who are doing it too. And some counties, by the way, the public defender's office will prepare and file your petition. If that's true, go to them, right? Then you don't have the hassle of trying to figure out all the paperwork and stuff. And it doesn't cost you any money. But the fact is, if you can file your petition as soon as possible, there's a law that's being considered that could change who gets the petition and why. So if you're eligible, please go forward now. Once I get the permission to share with you what that is, it's probably going to be next month. I will share with you what they're thinking about. Speaking of next month, though, too, I want to remind you that March 12th is the next meeting that we have, the next Zoom meeting that we have. And I'm sure that Ellie will be here and probably Roger and Rick, and we will be able to share, you know, even newer information with you then. I don't want to end this meeting at this point in time. So if anybody else has any questions or comments about anything that we've covered today, or maybe something we haven't covered, this is the time to do it.
Ben has a question.
Yeah. Hi, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the registration removal process.
Yes, sir.
I'm a tier one offender. I went through the process with my county public defender's office.
Yes.
And I started that process last year. And it took about 8 months. And eventually the public defender was able to be successful, and the judge ruled in favor of the petition for removal. And that came through in August. I had been required to register in January. And so I never received anything other than a verbal confirmation from the public defender that, that I was successful. So, I contacted the local law enforcement before to make the appointment, just to be sure. And they told me that the Department of Justice didn't have record of that and that I did need to come in. So I went to the courthouse and I got a copy of the order of the judge granting the petition. And I brought that copy into the law enforcement. And they told me that until the Department of Justice updates their system, that I should continue to register just in case, just to play safe. And I said, well, here's a copy of the document. And they said, yeah, I'm able to see that on their computer. I don't know what they were looking at, but I guess to the court, they were able to confirm that indeed it was granted, but that until the Department of Justice's system was updated, I was still at risk of being detained, hassled, bothered by law enforcement for any other reason. So I went back to the public defender. I told them what was told to me, and they said so what they told me was that the court needs to forward that information to the Department of Justice. So I went back to the public defender, and they said that they talked to the court and that it was on its way, and to give it a little while. And I'm still kind of waiting to verify that.
All right, Ben, I'm going to stop you here. I'm really sorry that happened to you. If you give me a copy of the court order, I will send it to Department of Justice on Monday. This is total bullshit, right? Oh, come on. The courts are supposed to do these things, but they don't do it. I'll tell you what I do for my clients, and I know you're not my client, and I don't care. I'll do it for you anyway. The fact is, when my clients get that court order granting the petition, I send it the same day to Department of Justice, and I can do it by email, all right? And they always acknowledge receipt. And in the email, I say, here's a court order removing somebody from the registry. Oh, by the way, you know, please do it today, or at least immediately, and get you off the Megan Saul website too. This is total bullshit.
Okay.
Do you have my email address, Ben?
I don't know if I do or not.
All right. I'm putting it in the chat.
Okay. Thank you. I'll email you. Thanks.
And then they wonder why we don't have faith and confidence in our legal system, right? I mean, literally, the courts are supposed to do it. It is their burden to do it. But so many times they drop the ball that I don't rely upon them anymore. Okay. And by the way, the Department of Justice, they make changes to the Megan Saul website almost every day in the evening, by the way. So the fact is that, they can take somebody off, it's quicker than I can snap my fingers. They can get somebody off the registry and off the Megan Saul website overnight, literally overnight. So if this has happened to anybody else, please let me know. I think, Ellie, you don't even do this, but I will do it. Also, by the way, if you're off the registry, I also send a notice to the Department of Homeland Security and then say, get this person off of the federal registry. The federal government really literally does not have a registry, but the fact is they compile the information, right? And so I want to make sure that you also get off of their list of registered well. So sorry to emote so strongly there, but obviously I have strong feelings about it. Okay, so to
Janice, one person is waiting for a while. Mitch?
I don't see a hand up. Okay.
I can't put my hand up. I don't understand how it works on your app. It's not like a normal Zoom meeting. My issue is simple. I was in SOT and I said, hey, I'm due for my evaluation to come off parole. So they submitted a report which basically guaranteed I was going to be on parole for another year. And at my containment hearing, I said, would you please read this statement? They read their own statement where it proved they were cutting and pasting in the report. The parole supervisor asked them for a new report. And I keep on saying, hey, now that we have a new report, now that I'm no longer in SOT, why am I still on parole? And I can't get a response.
Mitch, I'd be happy to talk to you next week about this. And folks, when there's something like this, such as so specific to an individual, it's just better that you have a private consultation with an attorney. You don't want it recorded. Okay.
Right. But I'm just saying they are dragging their feet intentionally as much as they can.
I agree. And you know what? I mean, the treatment, the Department of Corrections and the treatment providers often point fingers at each other. And it's like, no, it's not my fault. It's their fault. Right. Including not getting the Form 3043, not being, you know, allowed to come to containment meeting. And I'm just tired of that bullshit. I really, really am. It's like, yes, CDCR, you are the responsible party here. You might have hired the treatment provider because that's what they do under contract, right? They might have hired, but it is your responsibility and you cannot delegate the responsibility. But let me give you all a brief glimpse into what the heck is going on. Treatment providers and CDCR both are doing this and keeping people on parole as long as possible because of the money. There's a financial incentive here for both sides, CDCR and the financial provider. I'm sorry, the treatment providers. So this is an example. I have a copy of one contract that CDCR has with one treatment provider. The amount of that contract is $16.4 million. $16.4 million, and that's for 300 people maximum. They're being given $16.4 million over a four-year period. So it's only $4.1 million a year, but that's a hell of a lot of money, right? So the treatment providers are in it for the money, for sure. They're getting under contract with CDCR, and CDCR is benefiting from this because the larger the number of people on parole, guess what? The larger their budget is. So both sides. And it's just, it blows my mind. But this is it's the money train. So many times I'm hearing about people and the treatment provider won't put anybody on maintenance. And if they don't put you on maintenance, then you can't get early discharge on parole. I mean, all different games being played here, folks. That's one reason that we have sued the Department of Corrections as many times as we have. And we will continue to do until they get it right. Hi, Ellie, huh? Ellie's the president. I just do what Ellie tells me to do.
Ellie and Janice, Oscar had a question for you.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead and unmute Oscar. Go ahead, Oscar.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, wow. Well, this is all new to me, and I have a lot to learn. It's a lot to take in. This is the first time I've been able to do this, and I did talk to Roger the other day, and he gave me about 2 hours' worth of instructions on my computer. But at any rate, I'm 77 years old. We all think we are in the right position. I think I'm in the right position to do a lot of litigating and plan to do it. I'm an old jailhouse lawyer, so I know something about courts, and I have been fairly successful, but not in helping myself. So I just want to get to know more about this and my options, and I'm all in. I'm fixing to file a lawsuit.
Fabulous. So, Oscar, can I ask? Are you on the? Are you required to register?
Oh yes.
And do you live in California?
Say again.
What state do you live in?
Alabama.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Okay. Next door to Florida, which it's a toss-up on which works.
I would probably agree there. Yeah. So, Oscar, please call Roger or call me next week and stuff, and let's see what it is that we can help you do or you can help us do. I don't really have many contacts in Alabama. By the way, I also warn people away from Alabama as well as Florida because your state is hostile.
Well, like I said, I'm all in.
Great.
I'm all in.
Very good. All right. Very good. Okay, I think it's time to wrap this meeting up, folks. And Oscar, by the way, welcome. I'm glad you were able to join us this time for the first time. Please know that our next meeting is a month from now on March 21. Until then, please stay safe and remember that we're here to support you.
Janice, there was one person. There was one person that was waiting a long time with a question in the chat. Is it okay to do one more question?
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. So, Mark, do you want to go ahead and state it? I think I unmuted the correct Mark. I can read it. Is 10 years time passed like Colorado, since there is nothing in the statute requiring residency, like 1203.4 expungement?
I think you're asking about the petitioning process, and you're right. Okay. If a person moves to California, you don't have to wait any number of years to petition. But if you weren't convicted in the state, the fact is the DOJ can take up to 2 years to determine your tier assignment. I know one person who was part of their meeting earlier today, she's having that problem. She and her loved one are having that problem. But you're right. There's no, and this is important because the process before the tiered registry law was called a certificate of rehabilitation. And under the certificate of rehabilitation process, you had to live in the state of California for 5 years just prior to filing your application for a certificate of rehabilitation. That's not true under the tiered registry law. Okay. So there's not any number of years that you have to wait. The number of years depends upon when were you basically released from custody, either prison or jail. Okay. Then that starts the period of time in which you have to register. If you are assigned to tier one, you have to be there at 10 years. Tier two, it's 20 years. But again, you can move from another state into California. You'd first have to register in California, and then you'd have to petition for removal if indeed you're eligible. So talk to Ellie or talk to me next week, and then we can help you figure that out. Thank you. Okay, Roger, I should ask you, are there any more people waiting?
Yes, Elaine at the very end of the chat wants explanation of why we're what we're lobbying for regarding possession of pornographic materials.
Okay, that's a good question, Elaine. What we're asking for is that people convicted of that offense be moved from tier three, the highest tier, all the way down to tier one, which is the lowest tier. And for people who get moved down to tier one, then you only have to register for 10 years in order to be eligible to petition for removal. So it would make a huge, huge difference for people convicted of that offense. One interesting thing here, folks, is that the federal government, in their way they do things under SORNA, people convicted of possessing child pornography are on tier one under the federal system, tier one, not tier three. And I rarely hold out or point to the federal government as a good example, but this is one of those rare times when I do. So, you know, and by the way, Sex Offender Management Board agrees with us that this should be a tier one offense and not a tier three. So thanks for asking that question, Elaine.
That's about it.
Okay. It's a wrap, folks. Thank you so much for being here today. Hope to see you next month on March 21. Take care. Bye-bye.